Their joy was so incandescent that it seemed to light the whole encampment and changed the mood of all those around them. Even the herd boys were aware that something monumental had taken place, and they giggled and nudged each other when they watched Jim and Louisa together. It gave them all something to gossip about, and even the threat of Manatassi and her impis seemed to recede in the face of this new fascination. Jim sensed the lackadaisical mood that was spreading through the laager, and did all he could to keep them alert and vigilant. He exercised the mounted musketeers every morning, honing the tactics of the fighting withdrawal they had struck upon almost by chance. Then he reviewed the defence of the laager. Each of the musketeers was allotted his station on the perimeter and given two boys to load for him. Jim and Louisa together drilled the forloopers and herd boys at reloading the muskets. Jim nailed a gold guilder coin to the tailboard of his wagon. "On Sunday, after Walenga reads to you from the Bible, we will hold a competition for the fastest gun team," he promised, and hauled from his pocket the big chiming watch on its gold chain that Tom and Sarah had given him on his last birthday. "I will time you with this, and the gold guilder goes to the champions." A gold coin was a fortune beyond the imagining of the boys, and the promise spurred them on until soon they were almost as quick as Louisa, although some were so small that they had to stand on tiptoe to rob the charge down the long barrels. They learned to cant the weapon so that they could reach the muzzle more readily. They weighed the powder charge by scooping a handful from the kegs rather than fumbling with the flask, and stuffed the shot into their mouths to spit it into the muzzle. Within days they were able to keep a ripple of gunfire running up and down the barricade, handing the recharged muskets to the front almost as fast as the men could fire them. Jim felt that the expenditure of gunpowder and shot was worthwhile. The boys were inflamed with excitement as the day of the loading competition drew nearer, and the men gambled heavily on the outcome. On Sunday, Jim woke while it was still dark. He was immediately aware that something was amiss. He could not place it, but then he heard the horses moving restlessly in the lines, and the cattle milling about in the laager. "Lions?" he wondered, and sat up. At that moment one of the dogs barked and the others joined in. He jumped out of bed and reached for his breeches. "What is it, Jim?" Louisa asked, and he could hear that she was still half asleep. "The dogs, the horses, I'm not sure." He pulled on his boots, sprang down from the wagon, and saw that most of the camp was already astir. Small Boy was throwing wood onto the fire, and Buckut and Zama were in the horse lines trying to soothe the agitated animals with words and caresses. Jim strode to the barricade and spoke softly to the two boys who were crouched there, shivering in the dawn chill. "Have you seen or heard anything out there?" They shook their heads and peered out into the darkness. It was still too dark to make out the tops of the thorn trees against the sky. He listened intently, but the only sound he heard was the dawn breeze in the grass. Nevertheless, he was as restless as the horses, and relieved that he had ordered all the livestock brought in from the veldt at sunset the previous evening. The laager was sealed off and barricaded. Louisa came to stand beside him. She was fully dressed with a shawl over her shoulders, and she had bound up her hair with a headcloth. They stood close together, waiting and listening. Trueheart whickered, and the other horses stamped and jingled the chains of their halters. Every person in the laager was awake now, but their voices were strained and subdued. Suddenly, Louisa seized Jim's hand and squeezed it hard. She heard the singing before he did. The voices were faint, but bass and deep on the soft dawn breeze. Tegwani came from the fire, still limping from his wounds. He stood by Jim's other side, and they listened to the singing. "It is the death song," Tegwani said softly. "The Nguni are asking the spirits of their fathers to prepare a feast to welcome them in the land of shades. They are singing that this day they will die in battle or bring great honour to the tribe." They listened in silence for a while. "They are singing now that tonight their women will weep or rejoice for them, and their sons will be proud." "When will they come?" Louisa asked softly. "As soon as it is light," Tegwana told her. Louisa was still clinging to Jim's hand. Now she lifted her face to his. "I have not said it before, but I must say it now. I love you, my man. I have said it many times before, but I say it again, he replied. I love you, my little hedgehog. Kiss me, she said, and their embrace was long and fierce. Then they drew apart. Go to your places now, Jim called to the men. Manatassi has come. The herd boys brought them their breakfast from the cooking fires, and they ate their salted porridge in darkness, standing by the guns. When daylight came, it came swiftly. First the tops of the trees showed against the brightening sky. Then they could make out the vague shape of the hills beyond. Suddenly, Jim drew breath sharply, and Louisa started next to him. "The hills are dark," she whispered. The light strengthened, and the singing grew with it, rising in majestic chorus. Now they could make out the mass of the regiments that lay like a deep shadow upon the pale grassland. Jim studied them through the lens of the telescope. "How many are there?" Louisa asked softly. "As Tequani has said, they are many. It is not possible to count their numbers." "And we are only 8?" Her voice faltered. "You have not counted the boys," he laughed. "Don't forget the boys." Jim went back to where the boys waited beside the gun racks and spoke to each of them. Their cheeks were stuffed with goose shot, and they held the ramrods ready, but they grinned and bobbed their heads. "Children make fine soldiers," he thought. "They have no fear, for they think it is a game, and they obey orders." Then he walked along the line of men who stood behind the barricades. To Bakat he said, "The Nguni will have seen you from afar, for you stand tall as a granite hill in their path and strike terror into their hearts." "Have your long whips ready," he told Small Boy and the drivers. "After this little fight, you will have 1,000 head of cattle to drive down to the coast." He clasped Zama's shoulder. "I am glad that you stand beside me, as you have always done. You are my right hand, old friend." As he returned to Louisa's side, the singing of the impis swelled to a crescendo, then ended with a stamp of hundreds of horny bare feet that rang out like a salvo of artillery. The silence after it was shocking. "Now it begins," Jim said, and lifted the telescope. The black ranks stood like a petrified forest. The only movement was the rising dawn wind ruffling the vulture feathers in their headdresses. Then Jim saw that the centre of the line was opening like the petals of a night orchid, and a column of men came through, winding like a serpent down the grassy hillside towards the laager. In stark contrast to the massed impis, they wore kilts made of strips of white oxhide and tall headdresses of snowy egret feathers. 20 men led the column. On their hips were slung war drums made from hollowed-out logs. The rank behind them carried trumpets of kudu horn. In the centre of the column there was a massive litter, whose interior was screened by leather curtains. 20 men carried it on their shoulders, shuffling and swaying, dipping and turning. One of the drummers began to tap out a tattoo, which throbbed like the pulse of all the world, and the impis swayed to the rhythm. One by one the other drummers joined in, and the music swelled. Then the trumpeters lifted their kudu horns and blew a warlike fanfare. The column opened into a single file, with the great litter in the centre, and halted just out of range of the barricade of the laager. The trumpets sounded a second blast that rang against the hills, then another eerie silence fell. By now the first rays of the rising sun played over the massed regiments. It struck sparks of light from the blades of the assegais. "We should strike now," Louisa said. "We should sortie on horseback and attack them first." "They are already too close. We would only get in 2 or 3 volleys before they drove us back into the laager," Jim told her gently. "Let them expend themselves on the barricades. I want to save the horses for what will come later." Again the trumpets sang out, and the bearers lowered the litter to the ground. There was another trumpet blast, and from the litter emerged a single dark shape like a hornet from its nest. "Bayeti!" thundered the regiments. "Bayeti!" The royal salute drowned the drums and trumpets. Hurriedly, Jim snatched up the telescope and stared at the macabre figure. The woman was slim and sinuous, taller than her bodyguards in their egret headdresses. She was stark naked, but her entire body was painted in fantastic patterns. There were glaring white circles around her eyes. A straight white line ran up her throat, over her chin and nose, between her eyes and over her shaven scalp, dividing her head into hemispheres. One half was painted blue as the sky, the other half blood red. She carried a small ceremonial assegai in her right hand, the haft covered with fine designs of beadwork and tassels of lion's mane hair. Whirls and swirls of white paint highlighted her breasts and her mons veneris. Diamond and arrowhead patterns enhanced the length of her slim arms and legs. "Manatasi," Tegwani said softly. "The Queen of Death." Manatasi began to dance, a slow, mesmeric movement like that of an erect cobra. She came down the hillside towards the lager, graceful and deadly. None of the men in the lager moved or spoke, and stared in dread fascination. The impis moved forward behind her, as though she were the head of the dragon, and they the monstrous body. Their weapons sparkled like reptilian scales in the low sun. Manatasi stopped just short of the cut line that Jim had cleared in front of the wagons. She stood with her legs apart and her back arched, thrusting her hips towards them. Behind her, the drums crashed out again and the kudu horn trumpets shrilled. "Now she will mark us for death," Tegwani spoke loud enough for them all to hear. But Jim was not certain what he meant, until from between her long painted legs, Manatasi sent a powerful gush of urine arcing towards them. "She pisses upon us," Tegwani said. Manatasi's stream dwindled, and as the last yellow drops fell to earth, she let out a wild scream and leapt high in the air. As she landed again, she aimed the point of her assegai at the lager. "Bulala!" she screeched. "Kill them all!" A deafening roar went up from the impis, and they surged forward. Jim snatched up one of his London rifles and tried to pick up the queen in the sights, but he had left it too late. As with all the others, Manatasi had held him enthralled. Before he could fire, she was screened by the advancing wall of her warriors. A plumed Induna had stepped in front of her, and in frustration Jim almost shot him down, but checked his trigger finger at the last instant. He knew that the sound of the shot would be echoed by his own men, and the first carefully aimed volley would be wasted before the enemy were in effective range. He lowered the rifle and strode down the barricades, calling to them, "Steady now! Let them come in close. Don't be greedy. There'll be enough for all of you." Only Small Boy laughed at his joke. The sound was raucous and forced. Jim moved back to his place beside Louisa, nonchalant and unhurried, setting an example to the musketeers and to the boys. The front rank of the impi was sweeping up to the line of white stones. They came dancing and singing, stamping their bare feet and shaking their war rattles, beating with the bright blades upon their shields. There were no gaps between the black shields. "I have let them come too close," Jim thought. To his fevered gaze they seemed already within range with those deadly stabbing blades. Then he saw that they had not yet reached the stones. He steeled his nerve and shouted down the line, "Wait! Hold your fire!" He picked out the Induna, who was still in the front rank. He was horribly scarred. An axe cut ran from his scalp, through his eye and down his cheek. The healed cicatrice was smooth and shiny, and over the top edge of his black shield the empty eye socket seemed to glare straight at him. "Wait!" Jim called. "Let them come!" Now he could see the separate drops of sweat sliding down the Induna's cheeks like grey seed pearls. The man's bare feet kicked over one of the cairns of White River stones. "Now! Fire!" Jim shouted this, and the first volley was a single clap of thunder. The gun smoke spurted out in a grey cloud bank. From such close quarters, the rawhide shields were no protection at all. The goose shot cut through, and the destruction was terrible. The front rank seemed to dissolve in the wash of smoke. The heavy lead pellets drove clean through flesh and bone, going on to rattle against the shields and bodies of those behind. The second rank stumbled over the dead and dying. Those warriors coming up behind were impatient to get within assegai range. They shoved forward with their shields, knocking off balance the stunned survivors in the front rank. The smoking gun was snatched from Jim's grip and a loaded musket thrust into his hands by one of the herd boys. The second volley bellowed out within almost the same precision as the first, but then each successive volley became more ragged as some of the musketeers fired faster, served more quickly by their boys. Mounds of dead and wounded piled up in front of the barricades, and the warriors coming up from the rear ranks had to clamber over them. The limp corpses were treacherous footing and slowed them down, while the muskets were changed swiftly and a continuous rolling fire thundered down the line of wagons. When the most determined Nguni reached the barricades, they tried to tear away the thorn branches with their bare hands, but the musket fire never slackened. They climbed over their own dead and tried to scale the sides of the wagons. The relentless fire from the redoubts caught them in enfilade, and they tumbled back onto those below them. The narrow wedge of land between the pool of the river and the high clay bank of the stream compressed the impi as they advanced in a solid mass. Like the sweep of a scythe, every blast of shot from the musket cut swathes through them. The wind was blowing from the direction of the river, into the faces of the attackers, and the gun smoke rolled over them in a dense fog, half blinding them and confusing their attack. The same wind cleared the range for the defenders. One of the warriors used the spokes of a wagon wheel as a ladder and succeeded in clambering over the tailboard of the central wagon. Jim was occupied with the Nguni storming the barricade directly in front of him when Louisa's scream alerted him. As he turned, the warrior stabbed at Louisa over the side of the wagon. She jumped back, but the steel point slit the front of her tunic. Jim dropped his empty musket and grabbed the cutlass he had pegged into the wood of the wagon, ready to hand. He sent a thrust deep into the man's chest, under his raised right arm. As he fell back, Jim jerked his blade clear and pegged the point back into the wagon, then reached back to take the loaded musket from the boy behind him. "Good lad," he grunted, and shot down the next attacker as he tried to pull himself up the side of the wagon. Jim glanced to his right and saw that Louisa had returned to her place by his side. The front of her tunic flapped open where the assegai had ripped it, and a flash of her tender white skin showed in the tear. "You're not hurt?" he smiled encouragement at her. Her face and arms were already blackened with the soot of gun smoke, and her eyes were misty blue in contrast. She nodded without smiling and took the next gun her loader handed her. She paused, let the oncoming warrior reach up to start scaling the barricade, and then she fired. The recoil rocked her back on her feet, but the man cried out as the shot whipped into his face and throat, and he slumped back onto the man beneath him. Jim lost track of the passage of time. It all became a blur of smoke, sweat, and gunfire. The smoke choked them. The sweat ran into their eyes, and the gunfire deafened and dazed them. Then, abruptly, the warriors, who a moment before had been swarming like hiving bees upon the barricades, were gone. The defenders gazed about them in astonishment, seeking another target to fire at. The bank of gun smoke drifted away, and it came as a shock to see the shattered impi running and staggering back up the hillside, dragging their wounded with them. "To horse! We must mount and pursue them," Louisa called to Jim. He was amazed by her aggressive spirit, and that her grasp of tactics was so astute. "Wait, they are not beaten yet," he pointed beyond the retreating impis. "Look, Manatasi still has half her forces in reserve." Louisa shaded her eyes. Just below the crest of the high ground, she saw the orderly ranks of warriors sitting on their shields, waiting for the order to attack. The herd boys ran up with the water bottles. They swallowed and gasped and drank again, spluttering in their eagerness. Jim hurried down the line, anxiously questioning each of his men. "Are you hurt? Are you all right?" It seemed impossible, but not one had been touched. Louisa had come closest, with the assegai thrust that had split open her tunic. She scrambled through the afterclap of her own wagon, and within a short while emerged again. Her face and arms were scrubbed pink. She wore a fresh tunic and a starched ironed headcloth bound about her hair. She hurried to help Zama relight the cooking fires and prepare a hasty meal for the defenders. She brought Jim a pewter plate piled with hunks of bread and cuts of grilled venison and pickles. "We have been fortunate," she said, as she watched him wolf down the food. "More than once I was certain they were going to overwhelm us." Jim shook his head and replied with his mouth half full, "Even the bravest men cannot prevail against firearms. Have no fear, Hedgehog. It's hard, but in the end we will survive." She saw that he spoke to encourage her rather than out of conviction, and smiled. "Whatever comes, we will face it side by side." As she spoke, the singing started again on the hillside. The defenders, who had been stretched out in the shade of the wagons, pulled themselves to their feet and went back to their places at the barricade. The fresh impis were moving forward through the wounded and exhausted stragglers who were scattered back from the battlefield. Manatassi danced ahead of the advancing cohorts, surrounded by her drummers. Jim picked his best London rifle from the rack. He checked the priming. Louisa was watching him. "If I can kill the she-wolf, her pack will lose heart," he told her. He stepped to the side of the wagon and measured the shot. The range was long, even for the rifle. The wind had risen and was swirling and gusting. It could blow even the heavy lead ball off its trajectory. Dust obscured the range, and Manatassi was dancing and twisting like a serpent. Jim handed the telescope to Louisa. "Call the strike of my shot," he told her, and braced himself, holding the rifle at high port, waiting for the moment. The wind gusted coolly against his sweaty cheek, then dropped. At the same time, a gap opened in the curtain of dust, and Manatassi raised both arms above her head and posed in this dramatic attitude. Jim swung up the rifle and picked up her tall shape in the notch of the rear sight. He did not try to hold the picture, but let the pip of the foresight ride smoothly up her painted body. At the same time, his forefinger took up the slack of the trigger, and the shot crashed out as it came level with her eyes, aiming high to allow for the drop of the ball over the range. For an instant, Jim was unsighted by the recoil and the smoke. Then he focused again. It took the heavy ball a heartbeat to cover the distance, and he saw Manatassi spin round and fall. "You have struck her!" Louisa screamed with excitement. "She is down!" A growl went up from the impis, the voice of an angry beast. "That will break their spirit," Jim exulted. Then he grunted with surprise. "Sweet Jesus, I do not believe my eyes." Manatassi had risen to her feet again. Even at this range, Jim could see the tint of crimson on her painted skin, a rose petal of blood that ran down her flank. "It has grazed across her ribs," Louisa stared through the lens. "She is only lightly wounded." Manatassi pirouetted before her impis, showing herself to them, proving that she was still alive. They responded with a joyous shout and lifted their shields to salute her. "Bayeti!" they bellowed. "Zi!" the queen screeched. "Zi Amadoda!" And she began to ululate. The sound drove her impis into frenzy. "Zi!" they exhorted themselves, and those about them, and they came down to the wagons like lava pouring from the mouth of the volcano. Manatassi still pranced at the head of the charge. Jim snatched up the second rifle of the pair and fired again, trying to pick out her slender, weaving figure from the flowing tide of blackness. The plumed Induna at her side threw up his arms and went down, struck squarely by the ball, but Manatassi danced on. Fortified by her rage, she seemed at every instant to grow stronger. "Stand firm and wait your chance," Jim called to his men. The first ranks of the attackers poured across the open ground and clambered over the mounds of the dead and wounded. "Now!" Jim yelled. "Hit them! Hit them hard!" The fusillade struck them as though they had run into a wall of stone. But those behind dragged the dead and wounded from the pile and scrambled up into the hailstorm of shot. The barrels of the muskets blistered the fingers of the musketeers when they touched them. The steel was so hot that it could have set off the gunpowder as it was poured into the muzzle. The gun barrels hissed and sizzled when the boys plunged them into the water kegs to quench them. Even in their haste, they were careful not to immerse the locks and soak the flints. The need to cool the guns slowed up the rate of reloading. The fire slackened as the defenders at the barricades shouted desperately for fresh muskets. Some of the smaller boys were almost exhausted by the grueling work and were beginning to panic. Louisa left her place at the barricade and ran back to steady and encourage them. "Remember your drill. Steady now. Don't try to hurry." Through the haze of gun smoke and over the heads of the attackers, Jim glimpsed Manatassi again. She was close behind her impi, waving them forward to the attack. Her wild screams and ululation goaded them to mightier efforts. Many more of the warriors were swarming over the piles of corpses and reaching the barricade below where Jim stood. The smell of blood was in their nostrils and their expressions were wolfish. Their baying chilled the soul and weakened the arms of the defenders. Unable to climb the barricades, in the face of the steady volleys, the warriors began to rock the central wagon on its wheels. 50 of them heaved together, and the wagon swayed dangerously back and forth. Jim realized that soon it would reach the critical point of balance and capsize. The warriors would swarm through the breach it left. The assegais would drink deeply of blood, and the fight would be over in minutes. Manatassi had seen the opportunity and sensed victory almost within her grasp. She pranced in close behind the rear rank of the attackers and climbed onto a mound of rocks to see over their heads. "Zee!" she screamed. "Zee!" her warriors answered her and thrust with their shoulders against the wagon at truck. It teetered at the limit of its balance, seemed at any moment to be going over, then fell back onto all four wheels. "Shikalela!" shouted the Indunas. "Again!" The warriors gathered themselves and bent to take their grip on the axles and the chassis of the wagon. Jim looked back at Manatassi. The mound of rocks on which she stood was the one Jim had built to cover the keg of gunpowder. He glanced under the front wheels of the wagon. The end of the slow match was still lashed to one of the spokes, and the rest of the long fuse ran back under the chassis, under the heaps of the Inguni corpses, to the mound on which Manatassi stood. He had buried the fuse under only a light layer of earth. He could see that in places it had been trampled and exposed by the feet of the attackers. Perhaps the other end of the fuse had been plucked from the bunghole of the powder keg. "Only one way to find out," he told himself grimly. He snatched the next loaded musket that one of his gun boys handed him and cocked the hammer, then ducked under the swaying body of the wagon. "If the wagon goes over now, I'll be crushed like a frog under the wheels," he thought. But he found the end of the fuse and laid it over the pan of the musket lock. He held it there with one hand and pulled the trigger. The falling flint struck a shower of sparks from the frizzen, and the powder in the pan flared up in a puff of smoke. The musket jumped in his grip, and the shot ploughed into the ground at his feet. The flash in the pan had ignited the fuse. It hissed and blackened, then the flame shot along its length and disappeared into the earth like a snake into its hole. Jim sprang back onto the truck of the violently rocking wagon and stared across at Manatassi. A fine slick of blood was running down her flank from the flesh wound his ball had inflicted. She saw him and pointed her assegai at his face. Her grotesquely painted features contorted with hatred, and spittle flew from her lips in a cloud and sparkled in the sunlight as she screamed her death curses at him. Then he saw the length of slow match had been exposed across the last yard of trampled earth below the mound on which the queen stood. The swift flame shot along it, leaving the fuse blackened and twisted as it burned. Jim clenched his jaws and waited for the explosion. It hung fire for a terrible moment, and in that pause the wagon finally toppled over, ripping a fatal gap in the barricade. Jim was thrown from his platform and sprawled half under the wagon body. The attacking warriors shouted triumphantly and surged forward. "Bulala!" they bellowed. "Kill!" Then the powder keg exploded beneath Manatassi's feet. A mighty tower of dust and stones shot higher than the treetops. The explosion tore the queen's body into three separate parts. One of her legs cartwheeled high into the air. The other, still attached to her torso, was thrown back into the ranks of her oncoming warriors, splattering them with her blood. Her head sailed like a cannonball over the barricade and rolled across the open ground within the laager. The blast swept over the Inguni who had overturned the wagon and who were crowded into the gap they had opened. It cut them down, killing and maiming them and piling their corpses onto those of their comrades who had already fallen. Jim was protected from the full force of the explosion by the body of the overturned wagon. Half-dazed, he came to his feet, his first concern for Louisa. She had been with the herd boys, and the blast had knocked her to her knees, but she jumped up again and ran to him. "Jim, you are hurt!" she cried, and he felt something warm and wet running down from his nose into his mouth. It tasted metallic and salty. A flying splinter of rock had sliced across the bridge of his nose. "A scratch," he said, and hugged her to his chest. "But thank God you are unhurt." Still clinging together, they gazed through the gap in the barricade at the carnage the explosion had wrought. The Nguni dead were lying waist-deep, piled upon each other. Manatassi's impis were in full flight back up the grassy hillside. Most had thrown aside their shields and weapons. Their terrified voices were filled with superstitious dread as they screamed to each other, "The wizards are immortal! Manatassi is dead! She is slain by the lightning of the wizards! The great black cow is devoured by witchcraft. Flee, we cannot prevail against them. They are ghosts and the spirits of crocodiles." Jim looked along the wall of the laager. Smallboy was leaning on the rampart, staring after the routed enemy in a stupor of exhaustion. The other men had slumped down, some in attitudes of prayer, still holding their hot, smoking muskets. Only Buckut was indefatigable. He had climbed onto the top of one of the wagons and was shrieking insults at the routed impis as they fled. "I defecate on your heads! I piss on your seed! May your sons be born with two heads! May your wives grow beards and fire ants eat your testicles!"
"What is the little devil telling them?" Louisa asked.
He wishes them a fond farewell and lifelong happiness," Jim said, and the sound of her laughter revived him. "To horse!" he shouted at his men. "Mount! Our hour has come!" They stared at him dully, and he thought they might not have heard him, for his own ears still hummed with the memory of the guns. "Come on," he told Louisa. "We must lead them out." The two ran to the horse lines. Buckart jumped down from his perch and followed them. The horses were already saddled. They had been held ready for this moment. Jim and Louisa mounted, and the others came running. Buckut retrieved Manatassi's painted head and spiked it on the point of an Nguni assegai. He carried it high as a Roman eagle standard. The queen's purple tongue lolled out of the corner of her mouth, and one eye was closed while the other glared white and malicious. As the band of horsemen sallied forth through the gap the Nguni had torn in the laager wall, each carried two muskets, one in hand and the other in the gun sheath. They had shot belts slung over each shoulder and powder flasks tied to the pommel. Behind them came the boys, riding bareback, each leading a spare horse loaded with powder kegs, shot bags and water bottles. "Keep together," Jim exhorted them. "Don't get cut off. Like cornered jackals, the Nguni are still dangerous." They trampled the corpses and the fallen shields under their hoofs before they reached the open grassland and spurred forward. But Jim called again, "Steady! Keep to a trot. There are still many hours of daylight ahead of us. Don't burn up the horses." In a wide line abreast, they swept the veldt, and the muskets began to boom out as they overtook the running warriors. Most of the Nguni had thrown away their weapons and lost their headdresses. When they heard the steady pounding of the hoofs coming up behind them, they ran until their legs gave way. Then they knelt in the grass and waited like dumb animals for the blast of goose shot. "I cannot do this," Louisa called desperately to Jim. "Then tomorrow they will return and do it to you," he warned her. Smallboy and his men revelled and rejoiced in the slaughter. The herd boys had to replenish their powder flasks and refill the shot bags. Buckart waved the head of Manatassi on high and shrieked with excitement as he rode down on another isolated bunch of demoralized warriors. "He is a bloodthirsty hobgoblin," Louisa muttered, as they followed him. But when the Nguni saw the head of their queen, they wailed with despair and threw themselves down in attitudes of surrender. Ahead of the line of avenging riders rose another series of low rolling hills, and it was towards these that the remnants of the broken impis were flying. Jim would not allow his men to increase their pace, and as they rode up towards the crest at a steady trot, the musket fire had dwindled. The impis were scattering away to the horizon and offered few targets. Jim and Louisa reined in on the crest and looked down into a wide strath. a gently sloping valley through which another river meandered. Its banks were forested with magnificent trees, and open grass meadows lay beneath them. The air was blue with smoke from the fires of a vast encampment. Hundreds of small thatched huts were laid out on the grassland with military precision. They were deserted. What remained of the Impis had fled, the tail end of the army disappearing over the far rise of the valley.
"Manatasi scamp!" Louisa exclaimed. "This is where she mustered her Impis before she attacked us."
"And by the love of all that is holy, there are her herds," Jim pointed. Beneath the trees, along both banks of the river, and spread out widely over the grassy saucer, were the dappled herds of cattle. "They are Manatasi's treasury, the wealth of her nation. We have only to ride down and gather them up." Jim's eyes sparkled as he surveyed them. Each herd was composed of animals of the same colour. The black cattle formed a dark stain on the golden felt, well separated from the red-brown herds and the dappled beasts.
"There are too many of them," Louisa shook her head. "We will not be able to manage such numbers."
"My sweet hedgehog, there are some things of which a man can never have too much. Love, money, and cattle, to name a few." He rose in his stirrups and ran the lens of his telescope over the multicoloured masses of animals, then over the last of the fleeing Nguni. He lowered the telescope. "The Impis are beaten and broken. We can call off the pursuit and count our winnings." Although the Nguni dead littered the grassland, not a single one of Jim's men had been wounded, apart from little Izezi, who had caught his finger in the lock of a musket he was reloading and lost the first joint. Louisa had dressed it, and Jim told him it was a wound of honour. Izezi held the finger aloft proudly and showed off the turban of white bandage to anyone who would look.